Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have John Ahlquist and Margaret Levy, who are the authors of In the Interest of Others, Organizations and Social Activism. John and Margaret, how are you two doing today?
Just great.
Very well, thank you.
Wonderful. John, maybe I can start with you. Maybe we can just learn a little bit more about who you are, where you are, sort of your background. Who are you, John?
So we are at the moment in Providence, Rhode Island, but I am an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I come from California, but I've lived in a variety of places, and I do work mainly in political economy issues, so democratic governance and market institutions and the extent to which they can play together nicely.
Great. And Margaret, how about yourself?
We're sitting in Providence because right now I'm a senior fellow at the Watson Institute at Brown University. And I'm also the Jerry Bachrach Professor of Political Science at the University of Washington, where I've been for a very long time. And I'm heading back to Seattle tomorrow. And most of my work is on building governments that are responsive and accountable and deliver to their citizens.
Great. This is such an interesting book and so many different aspects to it. Let's start at the start. You begin with an intriguing concept that sets up much of the book. So, on a very basic level, what is a community of fate? What does that term mean, and how does it link to what you're trying to accomplish in the book?
Great. Yeah, that's a question, a term we really enjoy. And it comes from, well, for us, it came from work that Margaret and David Olson, a political scientist at the University of Washington for many years, came up with in a much earlier paper, also about labor unions. And we've gone back and forth about how to best discuss it. And so the way I conceptualize it, and Margaret has probably a slightly different description, is when people come to believe that their own interests are bound up with the interests of other human beings in some way, that what happens to them affects me, and that we not only do we share a common interest, but we share a common fate, and that can induce them to at least consider the impact of their actions on others and to take action on behalf of others, perhaps.
That's how I think of it, too, and part of what inspired me and David to develop that terminology was the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, which is clearly one of the subjects of the book. Borrowed from the Wobblies, or took from the Wobblies, the slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all. And that really encompasses what we mean by community of fate, thinking about how the injury to somebody way out there who you don't even know could be felt as an injury to yourself and something on which you should act.
And the book has both this historical component, sort of reaching back, but also is very of today, and much of the book is about leadership, and you talk in the first chapter about leadership. You suggest that there's this four-step process through which leaders can convince members, and you focus mainly on labor unions, but convince members to think beyond their own immediate needs. I wonder if you could discuss briefly some of those steps and what they are and what organizational leaders do to transform the vision and to create this community of faith that you describe.
I think the first and most important thing that any leader has to do, whether it be of a union or of a government or of some other kind of organization, is to be able to deliver to their constituents and to be credible to their constituents that they're doing all they can to deliver whatever it is that those individuals believe they need. So that or even to persuade them about what they can get and can't get. And that seems to me to be the prior condition for everything else we talk about. If the leadership is incompetent, it will not have any capacity to persuade members or constituents to act outside their immediate self-interest. So that's condition one.
We kind of backed into the role of leadership in developing the book. It wasn't a place we started looking, and we finally kind of settled on the idea that we couldn't write and tell the story and build the models that we wanted to without an explicit role for a pivotal individual who has, kind of the way we model it is they have better information about how the world is working and are able to try to convey this information to the members. And once that problem is solved, then the leader is in a position to continue to make demands on the members. But it's that kind of initial need. In terms of the community of faith thing, we say, you know, some leaders become leaders for a variety of different reasons. Being a leader is not easy. Not everybody wants to do it. And the people that do choose to undertake to try to lead organizations typically have other goals beyond just, you know, being a leader. They have things they want for themselves, and those things could be just money and perks, or they could have political or social or other objectives, and the organization provides a platform for them to try to do that as well. And it's those preferences that we think are really important. And the people that want to have these other broader social goals are the ones we focus on as trying to expand the scope of action of their organizations. And the kind of second role you mentioned, the kind of the steps, the key thing for us in the book is that members, even if they don't care about politics, will be willing to go along with the leader if the leader is, in fact, delivering the goods. But they're going to need guarantees and ways in which they can both monitor what the leader is up to and monitor what their fellow unionists are up to, and also punish the leader in some sense if he goes too far. And those are the organizational rules and institutions that we focus on in a lot of the book historically.
There's another piece to those organizational rules and institutions which is crucial to this process of convincing people that they want to act beyond their, or are willing to act beyond their self-interest. And one set of arrangements really has to do with providing education and knowledge about what's happening in the world and about what you can do about what's happening in the world. The other very important piece of it is that these are rank and file democracies where this occurs, which gives the members a capacity not only to hold the rulers accountable, the leaders accountable, but also to challenge the kind of information that they're getting and to vote on it, to make a decision that's an aggregate decision and the leaders could lose.
Now you do much of this in the context of four different unions.
Mm-hmm.
Why these four? And what makes them each different from the others? What's your choice of case all about?
Well, all four of the unions are in the transport sector, and the importance of that is that they all have the capacity, should they choose to use it, to have some influence. They can act on they can act to close the ports or to close the roads if they want to make a stand about an important political issue. And people will at least hear them. They may not change the policies, but they have some capacity to at least do something to act on what they think is important.
Right.
And so that makes these unions all very interesting, but then they're all very different from each other. Two of them are quite similar, though in different countries and within different national legal frameworks and with different ethnic compositions, but act the same way and are both longshore workers' unions, the Maritime Union of Australia, the Waterside Workers' Federation, and the ILWU, the Longshore Workers' Association, Longshore and Warehouse Workers' Association. And the other two, the Teamsters, are very good at delivering the goods to their members. They're excellent at that. But for most of but they've never been interested, even in the contemporary period, in getting membership to do anything other than what it makes sense to do from a very narrow economic interest in terms of protecting wages, welfare, benefits, hours, etc. And the fourth union, that's the On the Waterfront union, those who've watched that film with Marlon Brando, and that's the corrupt union, which in principle has all these capacities but has neither a leadership that is interested in delivering to the members, though it makes money for itself, nor is it a union, even though it's had moments in the past when parts of it have been this way. It's not a union that's interested in thinking about larger social and political issues.
So So just a couple of quick things to add in terms of case selection, and then one other. We also wanted to make sure that we had unions that were existing in democratic capitalist societies.
That's right.
With free and fair elections and things of that sort. So we're not looking at, unions in the apartheid era of South Africa or something like that. And the other quick thing to note is kind of why unions, leaving aside these unions, and that was a conscious choice for several reasons as well. We both have interest in unions as interesting objects of study in their own right, and that's definitely part of it. But what makes them particularly useful for our purposes here is that, they're kind of like mini governments as opposed to a firm. You know, they have this kind of conflict between responsiveness and representation and accountability internally with being in a very stark, potentially conflictual external relationship with employers, with governments, with other unions that makes them look like little governments in some ways. And they can be organized in those ways. And they have these, the thing that's great about them in the countries we study is that it lets us get around issues of selection and screening that you might worry about if you were to, say, study religious congregations or something like that. The unions, the members end up in these unions basically because of the time and place where they are, and that's the job that was available for mainly men in this period who were in physical labor. So we're talking Teamsters and dock workers. And so we can get around the kind of, I'm going to choose the organization that already reflects my pre-existing interests. That's not really happening in these cases. The other part of this choice involves the union's incentive to not screen people out that don't fit what they want them to be already. So in order to be a successful industrial union, which all of these organizations are or think they might be in the case of the ILA, they cannot really afford to screen people out for political or social preferences. They need to organize as many workers as they can in these industries if they're going to be strong and effective unions at all. And so these attributes make them particularly useful for us from a research design perspective to get at not that screening and selection don't go on, they do, and not that they can't be very important, but it lets us avoid those issues in this particular study.
And as you just sort of are describing, people join these unions primarily for non-political reasons, but your theoretical work and your analysis seeks out how the unions transform those beliefs. So how does this actually work? What can union leaders do to get the rank and file members to believe the interests of those outside the union matter, or the issues outside the immediate issues of the labor contract matter? What's in a practical sense? What are the union leaders during the time you study doing, and how are they interacting to change these attitudes?
Well, there's a huge investment by the unions that succeed in doing this in various forms of education and knowledge production among the members. So they have union newspapers that have columns that talk not just about the latest contract negotiation, but also the latest international and national events that are of interest. They have education departments, and people get training not only, again, in contract negotiation and bargaining, but also in other kinds of things that they might be interested. They've all had workers' histories. They put a lot of investment in telling people about the history of the union and in informing them about contemporary politics and affairs.
Right. The informational story is absolutely critical, but I think the key thing that differentiates the waterside workers or the ILWU from the Teamsters, the ILA, is that they have leadership cohorts that actively ask the members
Absolutely.
To get involved. That's the first key thing, is that you have to ask somebody to get involved. That's the first mechanism. And then the key thing for us in the context of the model and in the book is you're asking them in a context. And not only does that context involve the information that Margaret was talking about, but it involves the pre-existing credibility that these leaders have established by being successful at getting good contracts. And it also involves asking in the context of organizational rules that make sure the members know that if the leader asks for too much or proves to be inadequate, that they can be replaced or otherwise punished.
So what would be an example that of a successful effort to mobilize union members to think beyond the union? Is there a case that stands out to you as just very illustrative of this?
Well, one of our favorite stories that we both tell is when we were interviewing some of the pensioners, old-timers of the Waterside Workers Federation in Sydney. One guy followed us out and he said, I never got that communism stuff and socialism stuff that some of the leadership were talking about. But when we were having lunch one day in the docks, having a stop work meeting, which is what they call it, and the leadership came and some of the other members started talking to us about the ships that had just pulled up to the docks that were from the Netherlands, and they were going to go deliver war material to fight the rebels in Indonesia. And he said, that's not fair dinkum. That's just not acceptable. And then they said, well, if you feel that way, we can do something. We can not load the ships. And so they mobilized and didn't load the ships, and they refused to do it throughout the whole most of the Indonesian rebellion.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, in the book, there's many, many examples. That, you know, part of the puzzle with these unions isn't just single one-off events like the one Margaret just described, but it's they've been able to maintain activities like the one Margaret described repeatedly over many decades and over many different leadership cohorts and many different cohorts of workers.
Right.
And so, you know,
and technological changes,
right,
and
right.
Legal changes.
So there's examples of the union leadership again in Sydney demanding that the workers stop work and march, or not demanding, asking the workers to stop work and march in defense of some journalists and politicians that had been imprisoned at the time under an anti-communist act in Sydney that basically made it a crime on some level to be a communist. And they did. It caused some ruckus within the union, but they did. In the United States, there are several examples of the ILWU asking workers to stop work, to basically go on strike, or to refuse to load certain ships because they were Chilean ships after the Allende coup in Chile. They refused to load cargo going to El Salvador in the 1980s. Because of the Civil War and the U.S. involvement and the behavior of the government forces in El Salvador. The whole union stopped work on the West Coast to protest the Iraq War a couple years ago on May Day.
And in favor of abortion rights.
Right.
That was another one.
So there's many, many examples like this. And, you know, these aren't necessarily going to the wall on all these issues, but they aren't free either. They're asking the members to give something up, whether it's a shift of work and wages. It's taking a risk in the sense of sometimes there may be police or other presidents that can put you in some sort of disadvantageous position. So these are all costly actions that require mass participation by the membership and require their consent and typically prior assent, and they're getting it. Even though these things have nothing to do with why these guys are in the unions,
working conditions.
We're not so much, you know, we are, but in this book, we're not interested in mobilizing around wage strikes because that's relatively easy to explain. We're more interested in mobilizing around issues that have nothing to do with their immediate economic interests as we can observe them as outsiders.
So how replicable are these findings to either other unions, which it sounds like the findings are, or to other member-based associations? How far can we take some of the findings and lessons from your book to other settings?
We're still exploring that. I think that we can. I think the major area that I'm interested in exploring is how it translates to government behavior, which has a lot of similarities in sort of organizational structure. The dues paying is similar to tax paying. There's largely no self-selection into where you happen to be born, but there's a little bit of selection having to do with immigration rules, etc. But the big thing here is, you know, do we have leadership and organizational arrangements that work to elicit from people and understanding that they're part of a larger community and their fates are intertwined, or do we have leadership and organizational arrangements that encourage individualism? And I think there's variation in the world on that, and there's variation over time, and so I think the concepts that we're developing here are in fact translatable into understanding something very critical about government and citizenship behavior, which has been the issues that have driven my research virtually my whole life.
I mean, I would add to that, I don't necessarily think these findings, what we saw in these unions, are replicable and duplicable, you know, sui generis in some other organization in the same way you can't just replace a form of government with a democracy right away and copy one constitution in another place and expect that to work. What I think we have shown in this on one level is a demonstration of possibility and existence, that these types of things can happen, they do happen, and it's not, you know, necessarily a one-off thing. It can be sustained for a long time. We've also been able to demonstrate the conditions and the scope conditions and restrictions that you might pay attention to in these other things. So in the example of a nation state, the cost of exit, you know, can be quite high. And this is, I think our book actually echoes very nicely with like Exit, Voice, and Loyalty by Albert Hirschman, that when do you have the incentive and the ability to be loyal and to have a voice in your organization is when it is more difficult for you to leave. So in organizations where it's very easy to shift in and out, and just if you don't like it, you just drop and go somewhere else, you know, it's going to be more difficult for the types of processes we're describing to take hold and to possibly happen. If you're in a situation where the extent to which the leadership cohort actually needs the consent and participation of the members, if that is not that necessary, then you're not going to see this kind of thing happening. So, you know, I think we're able to make broader statements in that vein more than say, you know, if only the Teamsters had done something else, then it would look like the ILWU. I don't think that's the direction we expected it to go, and I don't think that's the direction we would want it to go.
I really enjoyed the book, and I have sort of a side interest in book covers, and you guys have one of the better book covers. I didn't see where the image is, but for those listening who are interested, I would encourage you to go out and read the book.
It's a beautiful mural from the Rincon Center in San Francisco, California, that actually depicts the 1934 Longshore Strike, and we were very happy that Princeton Press was able to get permission to use it on the cover.
Yeah, they are doing great things with their covers these days. I'm not quite sure. We'll have to talk to them about who's in charge of that, but this at least goes in my top 10 for book covers of the year. It's also a great read.